From William L. Dawson's only symphony, that was The Bonds of Africa, the opening movement of the work he titled his Negro Folk Symphony. And it was the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Joshua Weilerstein. That's all for now from the Manchester Classical Weekend, but I'll be back later on Radio 3 with the Halle Orchestra, and we'll be revelling in the raw thrill of Stravinsky's ballet, The Rite of Spring. Do join us again at 5:30.
Thanks, Tom. And now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Rainer Wynne is a writer whose first book, The Salt Path, followed the remarkable 630-mile journey she and her husband, Moth, made around the southwest coastal path. It was a story of endurance, as they'd lost their home, had little money, and Moth had been diagnosed with a terminal illness. But they found solace in nature and kept putting one foot in front of the other, living for the now, a message that obviously chimed with readers as the book became a bestseller and is currently being made into a film. Rainer has since written a sequel called The Wild Silence, about readjusting to four walls and a normal life after that seminal walk. And now Landlines, where she and Moth again embark on a 1,000-mile journey from Scotland back to the familiar shores of the southwest coast path. We're going to hear music from Britten, Schubert, Vaughan Williams, and first a folk tune called the Abbot's Bromley Horn Dance, and I think this takes us not back to a recent walk, but to your teenage years.
It does. This takes me back to growing up in Staffordshire. I grew up on a farm, very much connected to the countryside and to the land, but I didn't really know anything much about folk traditions. Not until I was in the college canteen when I was 18, and I looked up through this parting of heads, and there was on the opposite side of the room this young man dipping a Mars bar in a cup of tea. And I was instantly drawn to him. And by the time I left the room and looked back and he caught my eyes, I went out the door. I sort of knew he was the one. turned out to be my husband, Moth. But in one of our very first dates, we went to the Abbots Bromley Horn Dance. Now, that's a very historic dance. I think it was first done in the medieval times, where people dance in the streets of Abbots Bromley wearing horns. And there were lots of stalls around on that day. So Moth bought these plastic deer horns, and I watched him go down the street waving his hankies in the air with these horns on his head. And I was this desperately shy, withdrawn teenager. But as I watched him dancing in the street, wild abandon, I just knew he was the one.
He was your stag.
Obviously.
The Abbot's Bromley Horn Dance by Peter Knight on fiddle and John Spires on melodeon from their 2022 album, both in a tune. As we were listening to that, Raina, and I could see you were getting into it again, it occurred to me that although horns and everything conjures almost up a Monty Python type sketch, actually the idea of tradition and the lie of the land in music and culture is very important to you, isn't it?
It really is. I think those really old folk traditions that tie us to our past, they tie us to the culture of our countryside. And I think they're slipping away from us now. And it's a thread of connection to what's gone before. And I think if we lose that, we lose how to inform what comes next.
Well, we're not a million miles sitting here in Broadcasting House from Cecil Sharp House, which is a place that has really pioneered the preservation of folk music.
It absolutely has. It's held on to so many of our folk songs. And I've recently been connected to a folk group who have been holding on to some of those songs and reproducing songs that they've found through the collection at Cecil Sharp House.
Gigspan, a big band. You know them well because you collaborated on a project called Salt Lines, which we'll hear about later in the programme. But tell me first a little bit more about your life on the farm in the Midlands when you were young. Is that where you began to feel this connection to the natural world, but also the hardship of many people in the natural world?
I think so. It was a tenanted farm in Staffordshire, but it was in a time when the farm was carpeted with hay meadows and you could still hear the cuckoo as a normal thing. And crowds of skylarks would fly from around your feet as you walk through the hay meadows. I think one of my earliest memories in life is of my dad's feet in front of me in the grass as I followed him around the fields when he was checking the animals. And he would never drive around the animals. He would always walk through them. It was a matter of principle that he would walk quietly through the animals.
Also, you see things, don't you?
Yes,
you don't see if you're in a vehicle.
Exactly. You see things, you experience things, you understand the animals and nature in a completely different way.
Did you play any instruments in those days?
Recorder at school, and I think that's as far as it went.
But you wanted to play a banjo, didn't you?
I really did, yes. I really wanted to play the banjo, but I never got round to it. Life always kept getting in the way. Until very recently, I had a big birthday, and Moth bought me a banjo. So it's very, very much in the early stages of learning how to play that.
Well, you and Moth had many adventures together in your 20s, but in your 30s you moved to Wales. What took you there?
We did. We'd had this dream that we would find a ruin in the hills, a place where we could restore and create a life. And we found that place when I was 30.
And whereabouts?
On the edge of Snowdonia in North Wales. Yeah, it was a beautiful place in the mountains. So we spent the next 20 years restoring it. And the next piece of music that we're going to play very much ties into that. It was a piece of music that my husband Moth loved, because he'd grown up with music around him all the time. You know, it was something that was very much part of his life. Whereas in my household, I never heard music. It wasn't something that happened within our house. So the next piece is one that he would regularly put on the record player, and I would hear it whether I was tending the sheep or planting vegetables or on the roof repairing the slates. This would drift out of the door. So whenever I hear it, I think back to those happy days of restoring that property and family life in the hills.
Thank you.
Beautiful melody.
It is.
From Orfeo ed Euridice by Christoph Gluck, arranged by Giovanni Scambati, and played on the piano by Hélène Grimaud. So life was quite hard, I imagine, making a living and doing up a farmhouse.
It wasn't easy because we'd started a project there from scratch. So everything that we did to the house, to the barn conversion, to caring for the vegetables and the sheep and bringing up the children, we did it ourselves, just the two of us. I learned how to become an electrician and a plumber and all those things along the way. But because it was something we wanted to do and had a passion for, it didn't feel hard.
And of course, you mentioned the sheep, which you became expert at as well. And this next piece, I think, is associated with working with the sheep, isn't it?
It is in a way, yes. I mean, living in Wales, especially where we were in a place where the Welsh language was the first language. My children grew up fluent Welsh speakers. It defines the people. Just like going back to the horn dance, it connects them to their past, although it's growing into a very modern language now. And Bryn Terfel was very much an advocate of that and very much part of the Welsh culture of that area. And going back to the sheep, there was a day when we were passing through this little village on the outskirts of Carnarvon. Huge traffic jam. We got the truck, the trailer with a ram in the back that we were just taking back to where we'd borrowed it from. And we had Radio 3 playing on the radio and the window open. And there was a man walking up the pavement towards us with a newspaper in his hand. And as he got closer to us, he started singing. He started singing to this music that was coming out of our window. And as he passed our window, he waved the newspaper to us. And it was Bryn Terfel singing Schubert.
So you mean it was actually Bryn Terfel coming down the street?
It was, with a newspaper, just going home from the shop. It was just iconically Welsh moment.
You first heard this song, I think, in a wonderful chapel, or you certainly heard him singing it in a wonderful chapel.
I did, in the chapel at Ynys Enchi, which is just this tiny chapel on a tiny island off the end of the Penrhyn Peninsula in North Wales. It's the island of 1,000 saints, where there are supposed to be 1,000 saints buried.
Well, we have a recording of Bryn Terfel singing Schubert with another Welshman, the pianist Leo Williams.
Thank you.
What a voice.
Beautiful.
Litany for the Feast of All Souls by Schubert, sung by Bryn Terwyl with Leah Williams on the piano. Raina Wynne, so you've painted a somewhat idyllic picture of your life, if a hard one, with Moth. But in 2013, everything changed.
Well, Whitaker's beautiful 20 years in Wales, and our whole life was there, our business, everything. But sadly, in the background of those 20 years, we'd had a... well, you could say misplaced investment that had escalated into something more and eventually led to a court case and us being served with an eviction notice from our home. It was almost impossible to comprehend that we would have to give that place up, and we thought it was the worst possible thing that could ever happen to us. But in the week that we were given to leave by the courts, to the pack up and leave that property, as we were packing 20 years of life into boxes, Moth was diagnosed with a neurodegenerative illness.
Corticobasal degeneration.
Something that has no treatment and no cure. Mm. And it was in the final moments as we were about to leave the house and the bailiffs were at the door that we spotted a book in a packing case about a young man that had walked the Southwest Coast Path with his dog. And just in that awful moment, when we had nothing ahead of us, nowhere to live, we were about to become homeless, all the fear about what the future would hold for Moth, in that awful moment, just packing a rucksack and going for a walk seemed like the most obvious thing to do.
This was quite a gruelling trip that you undertook, wasn't it?
Yes. When it says coast path, it's not a walk on the beach, that's for sure. Yeah. 630 miles with ascent that's equivalent to climbing Everest nearly four times. So, yeah, not quite a beach stroll.
And yet the extraordinary thing was the walking seemed to improve Moth's health, didn't it?
It really did. We were probably about 200 miles into that walk when we started to realise that he was walking a little bit more surely than he was before because he'd had a lot of walking issues. He ran up a beach holding a fully erected tent above his head when only weeks before he hadn't been able to put his coat on without help. And his health was improving in ways that really we'd been told were impossible.
What did the doctors say when you told them how this had happened?
They found it quite hard to believe. Impossible with the research that they had to that point because the two didn't equate. Mm-hmm. But we've since encountered other people with connected types of neurological issues who themselves have improved their conditions through walking.
It may well be that something to do with the sense of well-being promoting a chemical change, I suppose.
It could be. That is possible. It could be due to the chemical influences of the natural world and being out in nature all that time. Mm. Or it could be simply the re-imprinting of a muscle memory by the repeated motion of taking the next step and the next step.
Were you surprised that the book was such a success? Or perhaps, in retrospect, it touched a nerve in lots of people that you had recognised in yourself?
I was initially really, really surprised because it was just a memory that I wrote for Moth. Mm-hmm. Initially, that's all it was. I'd written it for Moth so that as his memory was starting to fade, he wouldn't lose that time on the path. But then when so many people have read it and so many people have connected with it and taken so much from it, I think we all share those same emotions. I think I've come to realise we all share so many of the same hopes and fears and dreams in life.
And a need to be more in touch with nature, perhaps.
Yes, and absolutely a need to be in touch with nature, because so many of these pieces of music, they're a record of our connection to nature, and it's something we all crave. And I think to just live in the moment, to experience the now, was such a powerful thing to take from that walk. And this piece that's coming in a moment speaks to me of our time on the coast path, of the sound of the sea and the sound of the wind on the tent. But also it takes me back to the first time I heard this piece of music, when we went on a tour of Norfolk, sleeping in our tiny little van. My son was 10 weeks old, and it was the middle of the night, and he was crying. And I got out of the van, and there was lightning, forked lightning, coming down across the sea, a tremendous thunderstorm, and the sound of the sea just moving in and out, moving those pebbles, and this child in my arms. It was a very visceral, connected feeling of something beyond just being human, some sort of sense of real connection to the movement of the sea.
And Britten uses wonderfully a rippling, gurgling clarinet to suggest water.
He does. And in this piece, it almost sounds like the tide is going out and you can just hear it trickling through the little rivulets in the sand as it passes out. And walking that whole long stretch of the South West Coast Path, this music just kept coming back into my ears.
Thank you. The prologue from the Four Sea Interludes from Peter Grimes by Benjamin Britten, beautifully played there by the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Edward Gardner. Raina Wynne, your adventures on the Salt Path have led to a musical collaboration, as we heard, with the Gig Spanner Big Band. It includes two of the musicians we heard earlier, the fiddle player Peter Knight and John Spires on Squeezebox. The project is called Salt Lines. Can you describe it for us?
Salt Lines has been one of the most beautiful things to have come out of such a difficult time. The lady who manages Gig Spanner, Peter Knight's wife, Deborah, was reading The Salt Path and thinking, actually, there must be so many songs that come from that area that The Salt Path covered. And so together as a band, they researched the area through Cecil Sharp House and discovered so many beautiful pieces of music, and then approached me to see if I would like to do a collaboration with them, a words and music collaboration. And they're such a remarkable group of musicians. They have this rich depth of folk tradition that they bring, but then incredibly influenced by classical and Indian tradition and France and beyond. They sort of take all that traditional influence and then they progress it into something completely new, and it seemed impossible to say no because they were just so amazing.
Did you find it a very new experience combining words and music?
I absolutely did, because I grew up in a household where music was not a thing. It was rarely heard in our home, so I didn't bring what I thought was the necessary depth of understanding of music to this. But then when I began to listen to their music and the way they moved the music with the feel of the song, how they could move it in a different direction, when I started to put the words into that music, then I could feel a musicality in the words, that the words themselves had a rhythm and texture that sat alongside the music.
Your next piece of music was written by Hannah Martin, the vocalist. Why this particular track?
Even before I'd met her, she wrote this piece as a response to the book, The Salt Path. I mean, what greater honour can there be, or just beautiful thing in life, to have someone write about your life? Every time I perform Salt Lines with them, when it comes to this piece, I have to move to the back of the stage because it brings a tear to my eye every time I hear it.
There's a stain in the wound and the water, it blinds my eyes. There's a thirst in my mouth and the cold earth, it tells no lies. We always sat below the salt and the setting sun. We had to walk between the world and the endless horizon. There's a heat to my blood and the covenant, it holds us strong. But there's a parched road to walk and the journey might be too long. We always held to those four walls, to our landlocked home. And they said nobody worth their salt would be forced to roam. There is salt in my blood, there is salt in the deep of my veins. There is salt in my thirst, in the sweat of each mile we've gained. Drop of each tear as I talk. There is salt like a hope in each step of the path we must walk. Though it's salt rubbed my wounds, it is salt that has healed them again.
Salt Song by Hannah Martin, where we'll get you from the back of the stage, Raina, to the front, because you and Martha found a new home in Cornwall. You became custodians of an ancient apple orchard that I think a stranger offered you.
He did, yes. He was looking for someone to help him restore a wildlife to a otherwise really overused farm. And he'd read the Salt Path and thought maybe we were the ones to help him. But that time has come to an end now because we successfully restored the farm to what it needed to be. And we've now moved on, allowing somebody else to take it forwards to make the cider from the incredible old ancient apple trees that were within that orchard there.
What was it like returning to four walls and a comfortable bed?
I thought it would be really easy. I thought I'd just slip back into, well, what we call normal life. We found a little apartment in a tiny, beautiful little fishing village in Cornwall. Mm-hmm. And I really expected to just find it a pleasure to be back under a roof. But it was the absolute opposite. I couldn't settle, I couldn't sleep, it was really difficult. I'd find myself walking out onto the coast path in the middle of the night. Until the point came when I put the tent up in the bedroom and got back into the tent and went instantly to sleep. And I did sleep in the tent for quite some weeks in the bedroom. But I came to realise that probably the problem was that I'd never lived in a village before. I'd always lived out in quite remote, isolated places, never amongst other people. I felt as if I was losing that connection to the wild spaces.
Well, another piece of music which relates to the wild spaces and the sounds that one hears there, and one bird in particular.
Yes, the skylark. This has been really quite an important bird, really, in my life, because going back to that time on the farm, following my dad through the hay meadows, there was a point when economic pressures meant some of those hay meadows had to be ploughed and reseeded with more scientifically approved, modern, up-to-date grass types. My dad fought it hard for years because he really believed in biodiversity of the grass, but eventually succumbed to the economic pressure and, with a very heavy heart, ploughed up some of those hay meadows. And I never heard a skylark there again, which was incredibly sad. But as we walked down the length of the country, a 1,000-mile walk, as you mentioned before, we stopped on the headlands of the coast path running south to Berwick-on-Tweed. And as I lay on the grass, the sky was filled with skylarks. There were so many, and it took me back to those meadows, but also back to my mum's funeral where we'd played this piece of music. I first heard this piece of music in my uncle's house. He was an uncle I didn't see very often, but he grew a garden full of sweet peas. It was his passion, and the garden and the house were just full of the fragrance of sweet peas. And he put this piece of music on when we went to visit him. And my mum and dad sat on his sofa and listened, absolutely transported by it. And from a house where music was never played, it was a wonderful thing to see this transformation in them when they heard this music. So we played it at my mum's funeral. And in a way, the sound of the skylarks has wrapped my life start to end, I think, in some ways.
Thank you.
part of The Lark Ascending by Ray Vaughan Williams, with Hyun Park playing the violin and Benjamin Grosvenor the piano. Listening to that, does it bring it all back, memories of your mother and father?
It really does, but you can really hear that beautiful little bird in that music. You can hear it rising high into the air in song and then falling back down to the ground.
You and Moth, Raina Wynne, have been on another adventure for your latest book, Landlines, which I much enjoyed, walking yet again down the breadth of the UK, beginning in Scotland, a mammoth trip. And you articulate in the book several times a feeling of guilt for allowing or encouraging or even suggesting this trip.
I did feel immense guilt as we were walking, but at the same time, I knew why we were there. As Moth's health had improved when we'd walked the South West Coast path, when he became a little more stationary and wasn't walking so far, it declined again. And during the lockdown period that we all went through, he wasn't walking far enough and his health deteriorated really quickly to the point where he felt that maybe there was no way back and it was heading towards the end stages. But I couldn't face just accepting that without trying one more time. And so I found this little guidebook we had to the Cape Wrath Trail in the north of Scotland, the most remote, most isolated trail in the country. And I thought, you know, if anywhere will encourage him to try just to walk one more time, it would be there because it's somewhere he'd always wanted to spend time. So I left the guidebook in the kitchen and in the bathroom and on the table. And eventually he came into the kitchen and slapped it on the worktop and said, we're going north then. So we found ourselves there on the edge of the great wilderness. I mean, it speaks for itself. And Noidart, the fantastic stretches of Scotland where you can only reach them on foot or by boat. And yet he had this awful life-limiting disease that was deteriorating quickly. And I'd encouraged him to be there, exposed to the weather and the illness and
The midges.
Oh, the midges.
How did he cope, though, physically? Because there were times when you both despaired, if one's honest.
We did despair and we didn't think we'd be able to do it. And we did start out thinking we were just doing a Cape Wrath Trail, 230 miles. But the further we walked, slowly, very slowly, not quickly like it had been on the coast path, but very slowly his health started to improve. And then we found ourselves at the end of the Cape Wrath Trail and he just felt he'd like to push it a bit further just to see if his health would improve. So we went a bit further and a bit further. And eventually we walked the whole length of the country back to the south coast of Cornwall.
Of course,
as you do.
But there was a moment when you were stuck in a ravine, wasn't there, and thought you might not even get out.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, absolutely. We were in this little ravine in the north of Scotland. It's a ravine where this incredibly high waterfall falls down through it. And we were on a foot wide piece of path on a hillside that was like 80 degrees. And there was no way up and there was no way down, and we thought maybe we might just be stuck there forever. But eventually we found our way out.
I was very fascinated by the fact that quite often when you were feeling despair, your feet were terribly bad at one point, his feet were terribly bad, you talk, the two of you, oh well, we could just get the bus and the train home now. And it never really happens, because you then suddenly start thinking, but what if?
Just one more walk, just a few more miles. There's something about long-distance walking that is quite addictive. And when you get into the rhythm, you fall into that rhythm of days and then weeks of walking. You don't want to give it up, because it's like riding a rhythm through a beautiful piece of music. Somehow you find the rhythm within yourself, in those steps, in the next step, in the next bar, in the next beat.
And you often speak about the difference in footfall, if I can put it that way, that a certain piece of land will feel different to walk on.
I think it does. I think we found each of those paths and trails that we walked on had a different character, a different atmosphere, as if those paths carried the energy of the people who'd walked over them and created them. And there was something of that human energy imprinted into the land. And we were connecting to that as we walked over it.
How different did you find walking much more inland? Because I keep noticing in the book a desire to get back to the sea, to get back to the coast.
Yes. I grew up in Staffordshire, about as landlocked as you can be. And I only saw the sea once a year on a family holiday. But when we spent that time on the coast path, there's something about that endless horizon as it stretches away from you. It gives you this incredible sense of freedom and possibility. And it took me a while to actually adapt to walking inland because it had a completely different feel. Yes, you had that endless stretch of land ahead of you, but there's something about that ever-present horizon that I think I've connected to now far more deeply than I ever realised.
Now, one question, I feel awkward asking you this, but I'm sure every reader will want to know, how is Moth?
He's really well at the moment, actually. He's recently walked the London Marathon. Not run, walked the London Marathon. It took us 8 hours and 17 minutes to complete it. And, he's in good health at the moment. Thank you.
So it's very nice to finish on something that you find particularly evocative of the kind of sounds that you like and that actually take you to nature.
Absolutely. This music is just remarkable. I first heard it on a Radio 4 programme and it was an acoustic version played live in the studio. It's called Orana Roin, the Song of the Seal, and it's sung in Scottish Gaelic. You may not understand the words, but it doesn't matter because it's not about the words. This is about the sound of the voice and how that sound describes the landscape. Just the sound of that voice puts me immediately into the craggy, rocky heather of Scotland with the sea breaking in against the Summer Isles.
Are you planning any more walks, Raina Wynne?
Oh, yes, for sure.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Smithix and G.